Hello and welcome to Feet First, a podcast focusing on the front of the pack in the UK trail and ultra running scene. My name's Ed Scott, and in this episode, I am bringing you a race preview ahead of the 2026 Winter Spine Race with Sophie Grant. Sophie is a La Sportiva athlete based in Andorra, originally from Down Under. She got started in ultra running right here in the UK over a decade ago, but she has since gone on to run some of the biggest mountain races out there, including UTMB and Tour du Jour. Sophie is a super experienced runner who, for a long time, avoided the spine, not really seeing the appeal. But as we discuss in this podcast, she's had a life-changing couple of years, and the spine is now something which she is ready to set her sights on and hopefully do very well at. If you enjoy the conversation, I highly encourage you to go and check out Sophie's movie Off Course, which she produced in tandem with Stephanie Case. I'm not sure if it's available yet on YouTube, but wherever you're able to see it, I encourage you to do so, because it goes into much more detail than we can on this podcast about Sophie's journey with IVF over the last couple of years. A couple of other bits of podcast news. There are still a handful of tickets available for the live podcast. This is on 16th of January in central London, or Dalston to be specific. Got a few special guests, including Centurion's James Elson, Hugh Tibbs, Poppy Collingwood, and a runner from TrailFam, the youth charity. We're going to be doing a bit of a past, present, and future of British ultra running as we head into the new 2026 season. As I say, a couple of tickets still left, so do grab those if you want to come along. Head to runfeetfirst.co.uk/live, and there'll be a link there. The next day, we're doing a group run with Trailskin and Poppy Collingwood, who unfortunately has broken her femur, so she won't be running, but she will be in attendance, and there'll be tons of great Trailskin products for you to try. That'll be the next morning. That's completely free, so book yourself onto that as well. Other podcast news, I will be heading down to Cornwall for the Arc of Attrition. I'm not taking part, but I will be interviewing some athletes ahead of the race and hopefully afterwards as well. And I'll also be crewing my friend during the 100 miler. So going to be a busy weekend for me. If you are down in Cornwall, do say hello. And if there's an athlete that you want to hear interviewed ahead of the race, then tag me somewhere on their profile. Let them know that you want to hear them. All right, that is almost all from me. Just a quick thank you to Petzl for supporting Feet First. Petzl have been at the forefront of hands-free lighting solutions for over 50 years, and they have just launched their newest light, the Swift LT. This is an ultra-compact, lightweight, rechargeable headlamp. 380 lumens, absolutely featherweight. You will never notice you're carrying it, but it is a great backup light or just a daily light for your trail running on your local trails. I'm going to be giving away one of these at the live podcast, so if you need another reason to come along, you can book your ticket now. But thank you to Petzl for supporting the podcast. If you want to get your hands on a Swift LT or any Petzl product, head to the Centurion Ultra Running store. There'll be a link in the show notes, and you can use the code FEETFIRST10 for 10% off your Petzl purchase. That will help support the podcast, and it will help keep the spirit of adventure alive in running with Petzl. All right, here is Sophie Grant. Sophie Grant, welcome to Feet First.
Thanks for having me.
An honor to have you. I always like to kind of ask people, if they're coming on the podcast for the first time, to introduce themselves, tell the listeners a bit about their running background. With you, I think that we could talk about that all day and we wouldn't even get to the main topic of this conversation. You've run so many races, so I thought maybe rather than ask you to summarize all of that, is there a particular race or a run that you would go to as a means of kind of introducing yourself, setting the scene and saying, you know, this is, of everything I've done, this is kind of the thing I'm most proud of, or I want you to know about me?
Oh, that is so tricky, because as a runner, I like to throw myself into every single type of race style and distance. I guess now that I am a bit older, I probably tend to favor mountain hundreds or further. So I guess probably where I am in my life right now, probably something like the Tour du Géant is the one that I have been like chipping away at. So I think that probably sums up where I'm at right now. It's long and hard and interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I could easily spend the next hour just asking about that race. But just if I've just got one question about it, it's, you've done that race more than once now, right?
Yeah.
What was the change like revisiting that race because it's such a vast thing to comprehend that I imagine for the first time you do it, you can't really get your head around it. Does that get any easier when you go back?
Yeah, for sure. Like the first time I did it, I stood on that start line shaking. Like I was, you know, I have had a lot of experience racing in the mountains, but I'd never gone into day three. And, you know, I didn't know what kind of happened after that. And for sure, standing on that start line the first time was terrifying, even though I had run pretty much all of the route. I'd run the first 100K quite a few times because I had started wreckying that because I kept on running the UTMB and I got really sick of the route. But I think once you do something for the first time, then you understand you're capable. And understanding that you're capable means that you can go back and start to tweak things. And I, you know, even standing on that start line, I knew I could probably get to the finish that first time, but I was just unsure as to what that was going to look like or what the journey was going to be. And that's why I want to do it. That's why I wanted to do it, right? Like just stepping back into that unknown when 100 mile mountain races had become something that I knew that I would get to the finish. It was just a question of how fast.
One race I wanted to ask you about, which coming off the back of the tour feels like going from the sublime to the ridiculous, but the first ultra result that I could find for you was actually a race that takes place in a few weeks, the Country to Capital. Is that, am I right that you got started running here in the UK?
Yeah, I did. So I moved to the UK when I was about 20 and sort of started running, I don't know, 20, whatever, 3, 4, 5, I can't remember. And I got into ultras because my husband bought me a place in the Marathon des Sables as a birthday present. And I then kind of just was like, oh my God, I don't know what I'm doing. And so I threw myself into every ultra I could find in the UK. And so I started the Country to Capital and I had no idea you had to navigate. I would have been completely lost on the, like, I managed to tack onto the back of someone who knew where they were going because I didn't have a clue.
It's not an intuitive route, is it? It was actually my first DNF and only DNF at the Country to Capital. It's got nothing going for it, that race, and yet it's somehow a classic.
Yeah, it's not
January,
one of the
no route markings. Yeah, finishing on a canal, and yet yeah, something about it.
I pretty quickly started to favour, you know, going to Trans Gran Canaria in the depths of the UK winter instead of Tone Country, something like Country to Capital.
Well, I mean, it's kind of a full circle moment coming back to do the spine. Before we talk about that, though, one race I did want to ask you about was Pika Pika, right, which you ran this year. I've been just fascinated by this race for a while. There's not much information about it. It just seems so ridiculous. So could you just give the sort of elevator pitch for that race and what drew you to it? Like, what is this race all about?
So it's in the Pyrenees, in the French Pyrenees. It is 109 kilometers with 11,000 meters of elevation. And it is on the most difficult trail they can find. It actually goes very close to where I live. So where I live in Andorra is very, very steep, very, you know, there's a lot of tricky trail. So Pika Pika has been on my radar for a few years now. I had a friend, Natalie, who told me about it and I was like, oh, it sounds quite good. And so last year was kind of the opportunity to finally have a crack at it, seeing as we're now living so close and I actually train on that type of terrain a lot. Mm. Oh, it was amazing. It was absolutely amazing. It, you know, like more than one moment where you absolutely could fall to your death. And I just love it. It's like a sky race on steroids. One of the races that I really used to love doing in the UK was the Lake Sky Ultra because in the beginning it was really, really spicy. And this is what Pika Pika is like. It's like, you know, 1,000 meter boulder descents and scree fields and just instead of going normally in these mountain races you just go to the col, but in Pika Pika they take you to the top of everything. And, you know, there's one point in the middle of the night where I'm sort of like, I can't remember how many 3,000, over 3,000 meter mountains you go to the top of, but we're all sort of scurrying around these different peaks that are all kind of joined together to be scanned by these people who are like huddling in these tents. They like, sort of stick a scanner out to scan you as you scurry past. But it's, yeah, it's incredible. It is definitely a race that you need to have a lot of skill for, though.
Yeah, I mean, the numbers alone, 110K-ish, 11,500 metres. For context, you ran 33 hours and you podiumed at 100K. Yeah. Like, it's insane.
Yeah. No, it's, yeah, it's definitely, it's what they call it, a race for mountain guides.
Yeah.
Really.
And at that point, is it still, I mean, this might just be, you know, playing with definitions, but is it still running? Do you still identify as a runner when you're taking part in an event like that?
Most of the rest of them, I don't identify as a runner.
And your training, do you consider your training running? Are you going out doing intervals on a 50% gradient slope?
I have a treadmill because there is no flat running where I live. I probably have from my house about 5 different vertical kilometers that I could do. But if I want to do any sort of flat running, I need to, you know, drive for 20 minutes into town. So I have a treadmill for intervals, and yes, I do a lot of hill reps for sure. And, you know, I have a ski road that I can run up. But I think, like, certainly for some of the races like Lavorado or even UTMB or in the spine, right? Like, I spend a lot of my training hiking up mountains and then running down them. So I actually have had to focus more on running than the, you know, the elevation, which I think probably is a bit of a change for most people in the UK who are probably running a lot and actually need to focus a bit more on the hiking and the elevation that they're going to have to cope with.
And do you see that approach to your training come through in races that are more runnable? I know you've done Festival de Templiers, even UTMB to an extent, it's not flat, but they're a runnable bit. Do you see that you're stronger than your competitors on those climbs and you have to work a bit harder on the flats, or does your training kind of cover that base?
Yeah, no, my training kind of covers that base. You know, like I still try and keep some running in there, and just as I get closer to a race, I just become more specific, right? If it's going to be UTMB, then I do more running. And if it's going to be Pika Pika, then it is more, you know, descending on really technical trail and like remembering how to scramble and, you know, like actually climb. So I think, yeah, I generally, as my, even the Tour de Géant, right? Like that's got a lot of running in it.
Yeah.
And if you can run those bits, then you make up good time. So yeah, I still definitely keep enough running in there that I find that I can go into races that involve a lot of running and perform. I think now living in the mountains as opposed to when I lived in London, my climbing is much better. It's, you know, I think I always used to, but I mean, it, even part of that is just my ability to now pace my climbing and not feel like I need to make up everything on the descent, because I was good at that and I didn't feel like I was good at climbing. But now I have strong uphill legs and I don't run the descents as hard as I used to, so that I'm not knackered for the next bit.
Nice. Yeah. I live in London. I live in Crystal Palace, the hilliest part of London. So I have at least 2 vertical 60 meter climbs that I can go and do. not quite 1,000. I remember hearing James Elson, who's, I know, a colleague of yours at Centurion, talking about Pika Pika, and he said that at one point he clocked a 70-minute mile, which I just thought was...
Oh, yeah, you're not moving fast. The thing about that race, too, is that, I mean, I think probably the last 9 kilometres of it is running downhill. Right. Like, really runnable gradient down into town. So you've done all of that climbing and basically 100K. It's, yeah. I mean, I remember at one point getting to a point on a ridge, and I honestly, I didn't know whether I was meant to go over the top. It had, you know, vertical drop on each side, and I wasn't sure whether I was meant to go over the top of it or climb around it. And in the end, I just had to wait for the next guy, because I was just like, I'm not quite sure how to attack this. But yeah, I think it's definitely something if you like to be a little, well, very challenged, but if you like to really have to focus when you race, right? There's no point in that race that you are just switching off, running along, thinking,
yeah.
Oh yeah, you know, what did I have for dinner last night? It is like, oh no, pay attention, because if you fall, this is going to hurt.
Yeah, so far removed from the kind of flowy South Downs 100 or something like that were so many Brits are used to. As we move through the darker winter months, I just want to take a moment to thank Janji for supporting the podcast. Janji make incredible high-performance running apparel that is designed to help you explore and connect with the world around you. I've just picked up the Rain Runner Pack Jacket. This is an incredible ultra lightweight waterproof that has this unique 360 core ventilation built in, basically these vents around the midriff that keep you nice and cool, stop you from overheating when you're running in the rain, but still keep all that water out and keep you nice and dry on your run. If you want to pick up the Rain Runner jacket or any Janji product as we move through the darker winter months, maybe treat yourself to a nice fleece or a long sleeve t-shirt, then you can head to janji.com, that's janji.com, and you can use the code FEETFIRST. That will get you 15% off your next purchase with Janji. It really will help support the podcast, and why not treat yourself to a little post-Christmas goodie? That's janji.com, use the code FEETFIRST. Well, let's talk a bit about then your next race, which is the Spine, which is coming up. I know you said you lived in Britain before. Was this race ever on your radar during the time you lived here? Why have you not run it before, do you think?
Oh my God, absolutely not. It looks horrendous. It looks it has always looked horrible, right? Like,
yeah. I think that's part of their branding, to be honest.
Yeah, and it was one of those races that I was always like, no, don't need to do that. Like, just really don't need to do that. It just looks really horrible.
I'm scared of that, or is that I'm not interested? And if so, what's changed, do you think?
Oh, it was absolutely, it wasn't that I was scared of it. It was just like, why would I do that when I could go and run in the mountains and not be in darkness for, well, at 16, 18 hours, however long it is, and not be, you know, trudging through knee-high bog when I could go and run in the Alps and, you know, but I think for me, the last few years have been really difficult, and my running very much has been on autopilot. Like, I've run the races that I kind of have always run, and you know, I've not had this real spark for what I've been doing that, you know, used to drive me to do the things that were big and scary. And, you know, even something like Pika Pika, like, I knew I was going to be fine. Like, it's not, you know, this is the stuff I train on. It wasn't some big, scary challenge. It would have been a fun adventure, but not something that really got under my skin. And this is the first race in a long time, I think, that's actually really, like, gotten under my skin.
Mm.
Because it just, it's very different from what I do, you know, it just, I think the thing that changed as well was I know a bunch of people that ran it, was it last year, right? And they had snow, and I was like, oh, I could do snow. I live in snow. Like, I do snow races. I can do ski, but like, I've got snow. I mean, I obviously neglected to see the fact that it also then turned into very, very, very deep bog. But I kind of was like, you know what? I think I'm ready for something that's scary, that's challenging, and that isn't what I would normally pick.
I'd love to talk about something which I think might be important for listeners in establishing some context here for what you're bringing to this race, and that's a journey you've been on with fertility and IVF. It's obviously a delicate subject. So in your own words, as much as you want to, could you just tell us a bit about the journey you went on and how that's kind of brought you to this point?
Yeah, sure, of course. So my husband and I were trying to have a child for many years. It wasn't working. And we then, you know, you spend all of those years wondering if the running that you're doing is the reason that you're not getting pregnant. And so then eventually we tried a round of IVF, which was not successful. And we didn't get like a lot of embryos to work with. So it was kind of like it was one and done. And so then I had to somehow come to terms with the fact that my life was going to look different to how I wanted it to. And through all of that, the running, like it just, I've always loved running and I've always loved the adventures that I get to go on and all of that sort of stuff. But it became, I didn't want to do it. You know, I wanted to be pregnant. I wanted to have a child. I wanted that to be what I was doing, and for the running to be, you know, as well as, not instead of. And so, yeah, I think I did. I just kind of went on to autopilot and, you know, raced the races that were in the calendar. And yeah, I did, you know, I did well, but I didn't really love it. I didn't have that. I'm really excited to do this. It was more like, yeah, you know, of course, I'm very, very fortunate to be able to run these races. But yeah, I just didn't, I had lost that spark for it. So it's nice to feel like I'm a little bit coming out the other side of that and to have something that I've really like sunk my teeth into.
It blows my mind that you can run the tour on autopilot when you're not really feeling it. That's phenomenal. But I know what you mean. I mean, I can't say I relate to, you know, everything you've been through, and we'll talk a bit about the film that was made about it. But I'm sure lots of runners listening can relate to the thing of losing your mojo a little bit and having to sort of reassess, well, what is my relationship with this sport? Why am I doing this? What is motivating me? And I think it's really fascinating that one of the decisions you arrived at through that process was maybe the spine, maybe there is something going for this hellscape, this ridiculous event.
It's my community, right? Yeah. Like there's the UK is where I started running. It is where I got all of my ultra running experience. That is my, those people in my jam. That's my like community. And I want to be back in it. You know, I run these races in countries where I don't speak the language. And you know, they're amazing. Obviously the volunteers are amazing. The races are amazing, but I want to be back in that kind of cocoon of British ultra running where you guys do stupid hard things just because it's, I don't know, it's just in the British kind of like blood to be like, how can we make it harder and grittier? And like, you know, it's, yeah. So it's, I kind of, I'm excited to be back in that.
A quick break to thank Trailskin for supporting the podcast. If you haven't heard of them, Trailskin craft all-natural, high-performance skincare products designed for runners by runners. All of their products are made to protect, soothe, and support your skin through the miles, no matter what you're doing day in, day out. Personally, I've been really enjoying the new Muscle Balm. This is a natural, high-performance balm for muscle and joint recovery. It's got built-in botanical extracts, essential oils, and it provides lasting relief after a workout or an adventure. If that sounds good to you, you can pick up the Muscle Balm on Trailskin's website, trailskin.com, and whilst you're there, you can use the code FEETFIRST20, all one word, and that'll get you 20% off your next order, and you'll get you £5 store credit towards your second order. That's trailskin.com, use the code FEETFIRST20. Okay, back to Sophie Grant. You documented the journey you've talked about with IVF alongside Stephanie Case, the North Face athlete, in this incredible film called Off Course, which I'm not sure is yet publicly available on YouTube or anything, but I'm sure at some point it will be out there for people to see. How was that experience kind of laying bare some, you know, some of the most difficult moments of your life and making a film about that? How did that change the experience, do you think?
It was really difficult. But it's just, you know, it's just so important that women are able to start talking about these sorts of things. And when we first decided to make this film, you know, we didn't know what the outcome would be. It could be that we both ended up with children, you know, and it just, yeah, for me, obviously things didn't work out and it was very difficult to continue to document it, but it is so important to me to be real and to actually to have kind of shown people that, you know, it's okay. I mean, it's not okay, but it's okay to feel shitty and bad when things don't work out the way that you want them to. And it's okay to take some time to grieve it and to try and find your way out of what you wanted your life to look like. And that when you do, you know, that there is, like, I will never get over this. This will always be a part of my life because my life does not look the way that I wanted it to. But there will be other things that I will now be able to do because I don't have a child. It was a hard film to make. It was a really, really hard film to make. But now, having had some feedback from people about it, it made me realize how important it is that we did do it, because everyone has a story around fertility, you know, whether they want kids, they don't want kids, they get to have kids, they don't get to have kids. You know, everybody that you know has some sort of story around it. And it's something that certainly in the running world, it is not talked about. It is, you know, shameful even to be, you know, talking about the sort of things when they don't work out. You should only tell people when it's good news. And I think it's just, it's important that we start to break the stigma around that.
Yeah, one thing I absolutely loved about the film was, and I don't know if this came from you guys in your brief or directly from the director, but was that it was very authentic. And Stephanie, for instance, was throughout the film at times working in war zones in Palestine and places, and you sort of saw glimpses of her life like that. And similarly, like at the end of it, it wasn't wrapped in a neat little bow. Yes, there was a degree of sort of catharsis and there was an ending, but there wasn't like, and this is the end of my story. It was very real in that sense. And I think with ultra running documentaries, you know, there's a lot of samey stuff out there. And it was a real breath of fresh air to just see, oh, these are two real people living two very real lives that don't have a neat kind of beginning, middle, and end to the story.
Yeah, I think it was really important to me when we filmed the end, effectively the end of my story. It was really important to me that it wasn't like wrapped up in this bow, because that's not how it is for me. That's not how it was for me. You know, I wasn't okay still, and I wasn't just, oh, it's okay, you got a dog, you know. That's not how it felt for me. And so it was really important to me that was shown, because I think, so you know, so often we're like, oh, you know, I'm fine, everything's fine, oh yeah, no, I didn't get to do that, but I get to do this. And you know, it's life's not like that, and it's okay to be honest about that and be like, oh, look, I'm not all right now, but you know, give me time and I will be.
Yeah. Yeah. Beautiful dog, by the way, I have to say.
Thank you.
Yeah. The hope, of course, is that, and what we all hope for is that, you know, towards the end of our lives, we look back and we say, yeah, it did kind of work out in a way, but it wasn't what I thought it would be. But obviously when you're in it, you can't have that perspective.
I think one of the biggest things for me in my life is to try.
Yeah.
Right. Like, and that was with the, you know, with all the IVF stuff, was like, okay, like I just, maybe it works out, maybe it doesn't, but I need to have tried.
Yeah.
And that's the same. I take that into running. I take that into whatever I do. It's like, okay, look, you know, maybe you get to the finish, maybe you don't, but just be brave enough to try.
That's I'm collecting these little phrases that I hope one day to put into a book or something. And that's, you've just said one of them, be brave enough to try. That's a brilliant one. Well, let's talk about trying then, and racing. You have a lot of experience in long multi-day events, the tour, etc. What are you holding on to from those experiences in terms of your training and your preparation for the spine, and what are you thinking about that's different? What are you changing?
I think the biggest thing for me with the spine is that it will be uncrewed. So the races that I do, my husband is amazing. He, you know, crews me. And like, I was thinking about it today, I've never actually had to deal with a big drop bag right? So this weekend, I will be running in and out of my house practicing with my very big drop bag. So I think the things that I will take into it, the I know I have the mental strength, right? Like I know that as long as nothing is falling off me, I will get to the finish. I will keep moving until someone either pulls me off the course or I am unable to continue. So I know that I have the mental strength and I will be taking that. I know that I am good in bad weather, and this is something the Brits are really good at, and it is something that I am so pleased that I did my racing and my running in the UK, because the Brits are good in shitty weather. And if you can be
100%.
good in bad weather, like, it's just such a skill.
I mean,
So
look, Tom Evans won UTMB this year in a blizzard. First man and first woman to finish Barclay, both British. There's definitely something to that.
yeah, there's just this like resilience, I think, of having to run in the UK through the winter. And I don't think it matters whether, obviously, it's harder up north and maybe a bit easier down south, but it's still, you're still building that resilience. And so, like, I certainly when I went back to Recce, it was really good to tap into that again and be like, actually, no, you just have to have the right kit and be prepared to keep moving, even when it's really like horrendous, and have enough food and you'll be fine. So I take that. And I also take, like, technically, I think I have a lot of skill from all of the racing that I've done of, moving over bad terrain. But yeah, I think the having to be in charge of myself for that length of time, that's going to be the biggest challenge for me.
Yeah, I mean, on that, sleep is a major factor at this race. I think, with maybe the exception of Jack Scott's course record, you realistically have to be sleeping a fair chunk of time. What's your strategy on sleep? How long do you are you comfortable pushing before you think, no, I need to take a break here?
So this is why I keep going back to do the tour, because I just have not nailed it. Like, generally, this last tour, I messed it up more than I've messed. No, actually, I messed it up pretty bad the year before too. But normally in the lead in, I'm pretty good at like sleep banking. So I will do a lot of sleeping, a lot of napping. So at least I show up on that start line able to, deal with that first night. Generally, I would say I'm generally fine through the first night and into the second, and then I would need a sleep of some description. This is different though, because we're dealing with cold, we're dealing with wet, we're dealing with different terrain underfoot. It's a different ball game, and the sleep is something that I am really interested to see how I manage it. I will go in with a plan, but I think what derailed me last year and or this year on the tour was that I stuck to my plan too rigidly. I was like, no, I haven't planned to sleep until I get to this place. And actually, I needed to sleep on that first night. I was really tired. I was weaving. I was like struggling to keep my eyes open. And actually, I should have slept then, but I was like, no, it's not in my plan. And smashed a bunch of caffeine and kept going, and I made it into wherever I was meant to sleep eventually, and had lost a bunch of time, and then it spiraled. So, I think the sleep is something that I am planning on having more sleep for this than I would for the tour.
And how much are you able to plan for a race like the Spine or the Tour or anything? Because I guess part of the appeal of it is just how open-ended it is. You can't know what you're going to be like 230 miles in. But do you, I guess, plan for what you can?
I mean, look, the tour's a different beast. There's so many refuges. There's like, you're not allowed to sleep on the trail.
Oh, you're not?
No,
Okay.
I mean, pretty much everyone has a little 5 or 10 minute, little nap here or there, but yeah, you're not allowed to sleep on the trail. So you have to sleep in a refuge. But it makes it, much easier in a way, I guess, to be like, okay, well, I know that if I just keep going for 2 hours, I will get to somewhere I can sleep. The spine, much less so. Although you can sleep on the trail, but I don't think anyone really wants to be doing that if they don't have to.
No.
So I think that the trick is to try and plan the big sleeps where you think you are going to be able to, where you think you're going to need them and where you think you're going to be able to have them, and then have all the list of toilets that you can sleep on in between. The spine is a ridiculous race, honestly.
It's come to this. You spreadsheet of toilets.
You start doing research on it and it's just like a bunch of Brits rampaging across the Pennine Way, sleeping in any open door that's available. Like, it just, you know, I've read of people sleeping on windowsills in shops, like inside, yeah. You know, there's churches, there's toilets, there's like...
So there's a great bus shelter by this corner of this alleyway.
It's just wild. Honestly, it just seems like such a ridiculous race.
Yeah, but that's its charm, isn't it? I mean,
yeah.
I'm a big fan of races. It sounds like you are too. Races that have a thing, you know, like the tour, you can just, you know, it's so iconic, the climbs, the elevation, the landscape. And I feel like the spine, it has its thing. Its thing is very weird and very niche and very, very, you know, shit at times, but it knows what it is and it leans into it, you know.
Yeah. I just, the more that I've kind of like dug into it, and I think that's why I'm so excited to do it as well. As really, I love to do all of that race research beforehand. I love to read everybody's like blogs and listen to their podcasts and find out what they did wrong and be like, okay, how much of that can I kind of mitigate in my own plan? A bunch of stuff's going to go wrong for sure. Like you can't be out for that long without a bunch of stuff going wrong, but just trying to see if you can make as little go wrong as possible. But yeah, it's just, it's its own beast. And certainly as an athlete and as a coach, I have already learned so much in this process about what you need to kind of cover that distance in the winter in the UK.
One last break to thank the Centurion Ultra Running Store for supporting Feet First. Centurion are an independent trail and ultra running retailer based right here in the UK. They stock it all, guys. Clothing, footwear, bags, packs, accessories, nutrition. It is the one-stop shop for all your trail and ultra running needs. Founded by James Elson, a bit of a local legend here in the UK. He and his team, they know and understand exactly what it is that trail and ultra runners want and need from their kit. So when you buy from the Centurion Ultra Running Store, you are getting your hands on the very best. Post Christmas, why not treat yourself to some goodies? Get yourself ready for the winter months and catapult yourself into 2026 spring with some good gear. If you want to help support the podcast, you can use the code FEETFIRST10 at the Centurion Ultra Running Store website. That will get you 10% off your next order. That's centurionultrarunningstore.com, and then use the code FEETFIRST10. I saw on your social media that you've been on a few training runs out on the course. It looks like you got a bit of a taste of some spine weather. As you mentioned, like last year, we had a total whiteout. It was absolutely beautiful for the first day, at least. What conditions are you hoping for from a sort of participant experience? What conditions do you think would give you a competitive edge? And are they the same conditions?
Ooh, I mean, obviously, everybody wants dry.
Yeah. Dry and cold is generally...
Dry and cold. I think the conditions I least want is just wet the whole time. Like, I think, you know, we're going to get a bit of everything most likely, but I think that would be quite miserable. Yeah. I think probably snowy, stormy, snowy sort of stuff, maybe. I don't know. I don't really know what would give me a competitive edge. I know that I will keep moving. And I think that, you know, if bad weather is thrown at us, I will keep moving. Like, I'm okay in bad weather, you know, I'm okay in blizzardy stuff. I'm okay in wet. I'm okay in all of in that stuff, you know. So I think while I wouldn't want it, I think a range of weathers would probably give me a competitive advantage.
Yeah, get to flex your sort of versatility, I guess.
You know, it's that thing. It's like if you can be versatile in these situations, then you have advantage over people who maybe just find them more difficult and like get in their head about them or feel, you know, like I think certainly for the Pennine Way, some of those areas, people could feel very exposed, very alone and very exposed. And I'm okay with that. I'm okay with being alone and exposed. So I think that's helpful as well.
Yeah, I think people sometimes, particularly international runners, are surprised by how tough the conditions can be. You know, the highest point of the race is maybe 600-700 meters, not that high, but in winter it can be a hellscape on top of some of those hills.
Yeah, and you're all of a sudden you have no connection to anybody or anything. You know, you could be, I've had that in the lakes before where you're just, you know, you could probably see somewhere but have no connection, and if you're in the clag, it's just, that's it, you don't know where you are, don't, you know. Help is not coming. And I think that's, you know, feeling like you are confident in your own skills to save yourself can be really helpful.
Yeah. This is a long race. When you're 2-3 days in, this may not be how you run, but I'm just thinking in terms of setting intentions, what are you like hoping to find out or experience? Is this fundamentally about celebrating life, celebrating running? Are you looking to kind of suffer and dig deep? What are you sort of hoping to come out the other side of?
I mean, does anybody want to suffer and dig deep?
If anyone does, I think it might be you, Sophie, looking at the races that you've picked.
The thing with that is like doing these races and trying to suffer as little as possible.
Yeah.
Right? So trying to control as much as you can so that you suffer as little as possible. No, I think, you know what, I am just so looking forward to the adventure of it. Like, I'm hoping that I can manage my sleep well enough that I'm not totally doolally along the way. Looking forward to anybody who decides to try and talk to me on day 3. but yeah, I'm just really excited for just the adventure of it. I want to get to that finish line and just feel like hopefully I've seen some new bits of the UK in the very short daylight hours. But even being back in Reykjavik, like, it's just so much fun to, you know, like, who has a named wind to go over Crossbell and to see, I mean, High Cup Nick just took my breath away, you know, and I spent a lot of time traveling around the UK and racing when I was living there, but I'm still seeing really beautiful new parts of it. And so I'm hoping I get to see some of that and then just, yeah, have a bit of an adventure along the way.
Super exciting. Can't wait to dot watch. It's always a difficult coming back to the office after Christmas, but it's always got the spine to keep us going. One thing I'm curious about is, you know, you've been on this journey, which is obviously not over, but looking beyond the spine, if that's even possible, are there races out there that similarly have that ooh, maybe one day sort of appeal to them? Have you thought about what else might be further down the line, or, you know, runs and maybe not races, just challenges?
Yeah, I've got a little project in mind for next year. We'll see. Okay.
Keep that one under wraps.
Yeah, we'll just see if we can make that happen. It's I've never had a desire to have a crack at an FKT, but I've found a pretty cool one. So we'll see.
UK based or
no.
That narrows it down.
Yeah. We'll just have to see if I can get, you know, everybody to line up to do it. And apart from that, I also want to do the PTL with my husband.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah. So it'd be really cool to have some adventures with him. You know, he was not able to run for a really long time. He was born with club foot and had lots of surgery, and only in the last year has now got a device that means he can sort of run far. And so it'd be really cool to have like a fun multi-day adventure with him. So we'll see.
Does he have an endurance background? Because the PTL, to go from not running to the PTL, that's quite a journey.
Yeah, so he's run a little bit. We did a lot of biking for him.
Right.
So there was a while there that we were doing quite a lot of biking. He's skied, does skimo, like he's quite well versed in doing long things. We climb mountains together, like he's the one that drags me up the Matterhorn and stuff like that. So he definitely hasn't done multi-day. I'm very interested to see how that pans out. Because he's obviously, I mean, he's crewed multi-day too, right? Like, he probably sleeps as little as I do when it comes to the tour. But yeah, I'm interested to see what that looks like to do that with your husband over many days. Yeah.
And one race I have to ask about, because it looks as though you're building a really solid CV for it, but maybe that's not intentional, is the Barclay. Is that something that's ever occurred to you? I know that Laz loves spine finishes.
I don't know.
I think that's a race where you have to wait until you know you want to do it.
Yeah, and I'm definitely not there yet. I also just want to try a bunch of other stuff, right? Like, yeah, maybe I want to try Backyard Ultra. Maybe, and I like kind of, I feel like now that I'm just, I don't know, I guess opening myself up to possibilities, I kind of want to try the stuff that I've always said no to, like 24-hour track racing, or I don't know, just the stuff where I'm like, oh my God, that looks horrendous. I kind of am feeling a bit like I want to have a go at sort of some of that sort of stuff. But who knows? We'll see. I'm open to ideas, suggestions.
Yeah. Leave a comment if you're listening. Sophie will come and do your race. Well, Sophie, it's been a real honour to catch up and find out more about how you're feeling about this incredible adventure, and I've no doubt many listeners will be dot watching as well. I always close the podcast with the same question, which is, what do you think is the most important thing when it comes to success in ultra running?
The willingness to try.
Nicely put. Yeah. Sophie Grant, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.